Hey, everybody, I'm John, I'm an alcoholic.
John!
How's everybody doing tonight?
Good.
At most pitiful, how's everybody doing tonight?
Awesome!
That's good. Thank you for coming out to see me tonight, thank you, Tom, for asking me to do this. I've told my story here a couple of times, but this is the first time on a Saturday night, and I hope to do better than I have in the past. I am a classic alcoholic. I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. That was driven home to me earlier this week. Thursday morning, I woke up a few minutes before my alarm clock went off. And I rolled over and I looked at it and I said, well, I could get up now, be on my merry way and get an early start before the long weekend. I could lie here and enjoy my comfortable bed for a few more minutes. That's what I decided to do. Just laying there, relaxing and enjoying myself, getting myself mentally prepared for the day. And the egomaniac started talking to me. So it's Thursday morning. You got to go tell your story Saturday night. You better start thinking about what you're going to start saying. There's going to be a couple of hundred people in this room, more people than have ever been in a Saturday night meeting. And they're expecting to be entertained, and you better do a good job. And the inferiority complex spoke up and said, be real. It's Christmas Eve. People are going to be staying home to be with their families. There's going to be four people there, and two of them are going to be working. You're probably going to have to stop talking to make the coffee. You might think about bringing some cookies just to make sure the people don't leave when you start talking. And I thought about those two things for a minute and said, this is going nowhere. I may as well get up and go to work. So that's what I did. But that's the way my brain works. I was born September 13th, 1957 in Chicago, Cook County Hospital. My father was transferred around a couple of places and we moved down to Doraville when I was three. So for all purposes, I'm a Georgia native. My family was the classic 1960s Leave It to Beaver household. Mother, father, two boys and a girl. We lived in a comfortable white middle class suburb. We went to a comfortable white middle class school. And I never had everything I wanted. But I had everything I needed. There was always clean clothes that fit, food on the table, roof over our head, mother and father who loved and supported everything that I did, as long as I was doing the right thing. Eventually, I stopped doing that. We'll get to that in a minute. I'm a pretty smart guy. I managed to make it all the way through school without having to study anything very hard. At all. I've attained an arrogance that stays with me to this day. Way back when, I just knew that I was smarter, better than you and you and you and you and all of you. If you didn't like it, that was too bad. You will learn to grasp the reality, the glory that is me. Needless to say, the world didn't grasp the reality of the glory that is me. And that just twisted me to no end. I could not understand how I was not the natural center of attention wherever I went, the natural leader in every group I was in, and the best at anything I ever wanted to try. I was unhappy with my situation. When I was about 10, my family went over to visit another family that had a couple of boys. We were in the backyard roughhousing around, and I got hit in the head with a hunk of 2x4. And I went staggering inside, all of a sudden I hit, I got hit with a 2x4. And my father was sitting there with his drink. He drank bourbon and water. And he said, here, have a sip of this. Being a good alcoholic at the age of 9, I drank the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I felt better. Didn't taste very good, but I enjoyed the effect, and I remembered it. And I'm convinced to this day that I was an alcoholic from that moment on, because I was the kind of guy that would get off of work and go into a bar, sit down at a stool and order a beer. And when the bartender would bring me that beer, I'd say, I'd like another. And say, well, I just brought you this one. And I said, well, by the time you bring me the next one, this one will be gone. And I thought everybody drank that way. I thought everybody drank that way until I was about 40. And that was just what I did. I drank for effect all the time. I did it through high school. I drank and did drugs while I was in college. College didn't last very long doing that, by the way. I went to the University of Georgia for a year, and I spent all of my time trying to be as comfortable as I could be, doing the things that were the most convenient for me. I had to schedule all my classes between 11 and 1, because I was not getting up early, and right about after lunch was when party time started. When I showed up in Athens, the first day that school was open in 1975, I had my choice of going down to register for classes or going to get a refrigerator for my dorm room. Can you guess which one I did? I went and got myself a little cube refrigerator, and I carried that son of a bitch all the way across campus on my shoulder. Proud as hell. Now there's going to be cold beer in my room. I went to late registration, and I ended up with a bunch of weird classes that I shouldn't have been taking. And I was thoroughly at sea. I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing there. I signed up for a bunch of classes, and some of them I went to, and some of them I didn't. Some of them I was hungover for, and some of them I was looking at my watch going, it's going to end in another 15 minutes, and it's going to be beer. And at the end of that year, I passed everything that I took. I had a couple of incompletes, because at the end of my last semester, I was in bad shape, and I sat down and looked at exams and said, there's no way I'm going to be able to take this. I handed in blank exams and took incompletes. And I talked to my parents and I said, I don't think college is the place for me. I think I should go get a job. So I went and got a job. And I drank on the way to work. I drank at lunch. I drank when I got off. Eventually, I had to go get another job. And I did that for several years. I had lousy jobs. I went around with lousy people. I lived in lousy places, and I drove lousy cars. And I didn't care, because if any of them gave up on me, there's another lousy job around the corner. Another lousy friend sitting in the next bar. Another lousy car sitting in the used car lot. I didn't dislike people. To dislike people, I would have had to care about, and I did. I didn't give a damn about anybody except myself. Eventually, I ran out of lousy jobs and lousy cars, lousy places to live. I was broke, didn't know what I was going to do. And a friend of mine said, you should enlist. You need some discipline in your life. You should do. And at the time, having very few options, I did. I drove my happy ass down to the enlistment office, and I took their test, and they said, we really like your test scores. We really want you to sign up. I said, okay. They said, here's this list, about this long, are things that you can qualify to do. And I didn't know what any of them were, except infantry. I knew I did not want to be in the infantry. My father had been a reserve officer in the artillery. Well, that sounds pretty good. What have you got in the artillery? He said, well, we can teach you to fix radar. Learn skill, learn some electronics. So that sounds like a good deal to me. Let's do that. So I shipped off to El Paso, Texas, Fort Bliss. And I tell you what, El Paso, Texas is not the end of the world, but you can get your seat from it. It is a place, the only thing that grows there is tumbleweeds. And when they get their first opportunity, they try to roll the hell out of it. It is a flat desert next to a mountain. And on the other side of the mountain is the University of Texas, El Paso. One side of the mountain is the school, one side is the fort. And never the twain shall meet. The school didn't want to have anything to do with the soldiers. We wanted to have everything to do with the pretty colors that went there. And they knew that we got paid about $400 a month. None of us had a car. We all lived in the barracks. Had very little going for us. Had very little way to get over the mountain in the first place. So we drank a lot. Being right next to Mexico, we smoked a lot of weed. We did pretty much every drug you can think of, being right next to the border. It was all right there for us. We had a job that was hard to quit. So you really got to want to get out of the Army, to get out of the Army. Guaranteed salary, room over our head, 3 squares a day, uniforms free. What I learned from being in the Army was get up and go to work every day. And there's always somebody that's a humongous idiot that is allowed to tell you what to do. Get used to that. There's always some sergeant, some lieutenant, some damn somebody who has the authority to tell you, go and do this. That's what you have to do, like it or not. So, I spent all my time in the Army drinking and smoking weed. Eventually that caught up with me and I lost my security clearance, so they put me in the orderly room, which was great because I didn't even have to do any work. I sat behind the desk and read the paper and answered the phone, filled out forms. And when my enlistment was up, the enlistment guy came around and said, you know, I really don't think you're that good a fit. I said, you know, I think you're probably right. Collected my sign-out pay, got on the bus, rode back from El Paso to Atlanta. 44 hours on the bus, drinking beer and smoking weed in the back seat. My father came and picked me up at the bus stop, and I moved back into my old bedroom with my parents. I got to get a job. So, I had some skills. So I went and got a job making satellite parts. We made parts to go on communication satellites. Some of the parts I built were on Hubble Space Telescope. And I did a real good job for them when I was sober. Most of the time I could keep it together during the day. This was a pretty big company. And in big companies what you have is there's somebody who likes making sure that everybody's birthday gets recognized. So, damn near every Friday, we're going to go out to lunch and celebrate thus and so's birthday. Great, let's do that. And that was the last they'd see me on Friday. And eventually, they decided that I wasn't too good a fit over there either. Because I was kind of a shitty employee. I had a bad attitude. I figured if I showed up and did my work, it didn't matter what I looked like, how I dressed, whether I had a bad attitude, whether I came back to work on Friday after lunch. So I got some more crappy jobs. I got a crappy truck, and I lived in crappy places. And I hung out with crappy people at crappy bars. And I got busted a lot. The most embarrassing thing that happened to me was I got busted one night coming out of a bar, 2:00 in the morning. And I just knew that son of a bitch was sitting in the parking lot across the street just waiting for me to come out at 2:00 in the morning. He asked me for my license, and what I had to give him was the ticket that I got for the DUI I got 2 weeks before. They really had it in for me. So, I went to jail for a while. And when I got out, one of the provisions of my parole was to go to AA meetings and to go visit a psychiatrist. And I went to visit this psychiatrist. There were some group meetings and some one-on-one meetings, and I talked to her and I told her the truth. And it seemed okay. So I need you to go to these AA meetings. And I had to go to 14 of them in 30 days. At the time, I lived in Gwinnett County, which has no rapid transit. So I wasn't allowed to drive to an AA meeting, and there wasn't one close to my house. My girlfriend would pick me up. I would get off from work at 3:30 and go to a bar and sit in this bar and drink iced tea, change my clothes, and read a book for an hour until she showed up, picked me up to take me to an AA meeting. And she would go and talk with her girlfriend for a while, and then come pick me up and we'd go. My wife is a saint. She put up with way more from me than she should have had to. We would get up at 5:30 in the morning so she could drop me off to work at Stone Mountain at 6. And then I'd hang around the convenience store till 5:30 or 6 when she got off, and she'd come and pick me up. And those were some long days. She stuck with me. I don't know why. But I went to these AA meetings over to Biscayne, right behind one of the sleaziest bars I ever went to, a place called Annie's. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it. I doubt it's still there. But it was a place where they only swept up the broken glass about once a week. And so I went to this room. It was about the size of this room, maybe a little bigger. Lots of tables like this, lots of people. And they didn't seem pleased to see me. They didn't come up and introduce themselves, and they didn't shake my hand. They didn't seem to care if I was there or not, which was fine, because I really didn't want to meet any of them. All I wanted was my signature on that blue piece of paper. And they would have their meeting, and I would listen to records in my head or whatever. I paid zero attention to what was going on in these AA meetings. At the end of the 30 days, when I had all of my signatures and I didn't have to go anymore, if you had asked me, I would have told you the big book was the Bible. That was how little attention I paid to it. I didn't get one. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't do any of the steps. But in talking to this psychiatrist, she convinced me that I had a drinking problem. So I decided to quit. And I did. I stopped drinking for almost 10 years. And it was the most miserable 10 years of my life. Worse than being an unemployed, homeless drunk. Being a dry drunk, trying to keep my shit together. Stay employed, be married, stay out of trouble. And it was hell on everybody. It was hell on my boss, hell on my wife, hell on my family, hell on everybody I met. And I had to take a business trip to Jamaica, which was weird in and of itself. I got down to Jamaica and I met the guy that I was supposed to meet. And I was working for a company that made closed circuit surveillance cameras. And I was meeting a guy with the Alcoa plant down there. There's a big Alcoa plant in Jamaica. And they were having a problem with people climbing over the fence and stealing things. So they wanted some cameras that could see in the dark. So we went down there and we waited till it got dark. I showed them some pictures from this camera and they were quite impressed. Things were looking up. And we got in the car to go back to the hotel. It's about 8:30. And this guy says, you know, it's illegal to come to Jamaica and not go out to dinner. We have some great clubs, the food is good, the women are pretty, the music is rocking, you've really got to come with us. So, sounds good. So we went down there and we found a place and the music was rocking and the women were pretty and the food was good. And we said, you know, it's also illegal to leave Jamaica without having a red stripe. And I said to myself, you know, I've been good for all this time. I'm in a foreign country that I'm likely never to come back to again. I'm leaving first thing in the morning. I'm going to have a red stripe. I did. I liked it. I had another one. I liked that one. He dropped me off at the hotel, and I got up the next morning, and I got on the plane and came back. Talked to my wife and said, you know, while I was gone, I had a couple of beers. And they were good. And I was able to stop it, too. So we talked about it for a while, and we decided that maybe with age, maybe being an alcoholic was a phase that I'd been going through. Maybe if we kept an eye on things, you know, maybe on a Friday afternoon I could afford to have one or two. So we tried that. Friday afternoon would roll around. I was getting a ride home from some guys at work. We'd stop and get a couple of tall boys on the way home. Life was good. And you know, some weeks, Tuesdays, were kind of bad. But we'd have to stop and get some tall boys on Tuesday. And I went right down here. All the while rationalizing to myself, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't lie about my drinking. I'm very open about it. I'm not living under a bridge someplace. I've got a job. Wife, friends, I got home one day and made myself a big old drink and I'm sitting out on the deck enjoying the evening after my long day's work and my wife calls me and we're talking on the phone and she goes, have you been drinking? And the first word out of my mouth was, no. And I knew that was wrong the minute I said it. Why did you say that? You've obviously been drinking. What the hell's the matter with you? We went on a company trip, and our company was going whitewater rafting. And I spent a couple of days trying to decide what is the perfect liquor for whitewater rafting. The answer, by the way, is Wild Turkey for anybody that really wanted to. So I got myself a bottle of Wild Turkey, a pint bottle, and I took it with me. Nobody wanted to share it with me. I was astounded. I couldn't figure this out. What's wrong with these people? I'm riding back from this place up in North Georgia. We're riding back down, and I'm riding in my boss's car with my boss. In his convertible XKS Jaguar. And I spilled a 24-ounce Wild Turkey and Coke in the front seat of his car. He looked at me, and I apologized. I was apoplectic. I didn't know what to do about this. He didn't say anything. A couple of weeks later, my wife was going over to stay with her girlfriends for the weekend, the ladies' weekend. And I was going to stop and have a couple of beers on the way home, get a pizza, put my feet up, relax, watch the television. And I woke up Saturday morning and had absolutely no idea where I had been. I was pleased that I woke up at my house. Crawled over to the window. I looked over out into the parking lot to see if my car was there. Yes, it was. Doors were closed. It was in a parking space. It looked like it had been in an accident. Things are looking up. And I was so hungover. God, I was so sick. I poisoned myself, really. And the husband, the guy that Tracy was going to stay with, was coming to pick me up to go play golf that morning. I called him up and said, no way, I can't do this. I'm sick. So my wife calls and says, sis, I hear you're sick. I have the worst hangover that I've ever had in my entire life. I feel like I want to die. It's horrible. She says, oh, click. This is not good. I burned bridges all over the place, pissed off people, disappointed just about everybody I ever knew. And right then and there, I knew that I had to do something. And I was laying on the floor, because if I laid on the bed, I was spinning around the wrong way. But if I laid on the floor, I was spinning around the other way. And I said, God, please help me. And I was sincere. And I wasn't asking for the jack to make that inside straight. I wasn't asking for the police to pass me by and pull over somebody else. Please help me. And I felt a weight lift off my shoulders that I had been carrying around for decades. I still had the hangover, but I felt like maybe there was something to be done. Maybe it was hope. I don't know. So my wife came home the next day, and we had a long discussion. And I announced that I had seen the light. It's time for me to go to maybe some AA meetings. So the next day, I went to work, got on the internet, looked up AA meetings at Woodstock. I said, how place? I said, great. Got off of work. Drove up and down Bells Ferry Road for a while, looking for this place. Finally pulled into this parking lot with this ratty building, and there was three guys standing outside drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. And I knew I was in the right place. And they welcomed me. They introduced themselves. They shook the hand, got me a cup of coffee. And I was sitting right over here, sweating and nervous. There was probably 100 people in that room. I didn't know any of them. Didn't know what I was going to do. I sat there and grabbed this bottle of water along with both hands. And I liked what I heard. So I came back the next day at 6 o'clock. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And after a while, I got a big book, and I read it. And after a while, I started thinking about getting a sponsor. And I was sitting back there in the beginner's meeting, and there was a couple of guys back there. There was a guy I thought would be a good sponsor. He was about my age, and he was married. He had some similar experiences to me. I wasn't sure if he might want to do it or not, so I figured, well, I'll talk to his friend and see what he thinks. So I talked to his business partner. I said, I'm looking for a sponsor. And this guy goes, well, I really don't have any time to be anybody else's sponsor. I got a whole lot of sponsees now, and I really don't have any time for this. I wasn't asking him. I was asking him about somebody else anyway. But I shut up for about a minute and a half, and eventually he talked himself around into this great big circle where he talked himself into being my sponsor. which turned out to be real good for me because he's still coming here, and the guy I was going to ask died drunk. So God was looking out for me. That was one of a thousand times. And we started working the steps. 1, 2, and 3 were pretty easy. And we got to 4, the searching and fearless moral inventory. God, that sounds scary. He had a form for me. He said, this will make it easier for you to do. This is the things that you need to figure out. Just work this form. If you need extra paper, use extra paper. And I started working on this thing one Saturday afternoon, and I worked on it for a couple hours, and it's painful looking at the wreckage I've made in my life, the bad decisions I've made, the people I've disappointed, fucked over, let down, used and thrown away. And I put it away for a week. I picked it up the next Saturday. I worked on it for a couple hours. I put it down. I picked up the next Saturday. I worked on it for a couple hours. And I probably put 18 or 20 hours into it all together over the course of several weekends. Filled up page after page on this legal pad. I said, well, I think this is pretty complete. So I went and did my 5th step. And that wasn't as painful as I thought it was going to be. That was actually very enlightening for me. I felt a lot better after I got that done. After I laid myself bare, I felt so much better. I had a new emphasis on my own sobriety. Time to go start making right the things that I've done wrong. I prayed, I made my list, and I started making my amends. Some of them I'm still making. Some of them I probably won't ever get a chance to. There are a lot of people I did wrong things to that I probably will never see again. And that bothers me. But I can only do what I can do. And I've come to a peace about my own life within myself. I'm not perfect. I'm not the glorious center of attention. Well, I am right now. That'll change in 15 minutes or so. But I'm a good person. And when I meet people and I ask them, hey, how are you doing? I'm actually interested in what the answer is, especially if it's something bad. Because now I have some empathy for people that I didn't have before. My parents brought me up to know what was right from wrong. And I've always known what the right thing was. A lot of times I rationalized my way out of it because it was inconvenient or uncomfortable for me. I know I'm supposed to go and do this thing, but it's a pain in the ass and I don't want to do it. So I'm going to find a way to rationalize my way out. I don't do that as much anymore. And when there is a conflict, I have, I don't know, 100 phone numbers. If I can't get a hold of my sponsor, I've got a lot of brothers I can call. And I don't have to shop around and get the right answer. All I have to do is get an affirmation that what I know to be right is what I should do. They're generally not shy about telling you that. And if you have been to the 6 o'clock men's meeting, they're not shy about telling you when you're screwed up. So I, lean on step number 10 very hard. I take my personal inventory frequently, many times a day. I'm in the service industry. Sometimes I have to shade the truth a little bit. If I've got 12 service calls I need to schedule people for, but I've only got 8 people to get sent, I may have to make up an excuse. I do it as straightforwardly as I can. If I say I'm going to do something, I do my absolute best to do it. And if I'm not going to be able to, I call whoever it is I'm supposed to see and I let them know why I'm not going to be able to do what I said I was going to do. And I try to be there when somebody else needs help. Everybody I know knows I'm an alcoholic. Everybody I know knows I'm an AA. My family was good enough to completely rearrange their Christmas Eve schedule so I could be here tonight instead of celebrating with them. We had our little Christmas party earlier with my brothers earlier today. And I've run into a lot of my customers that know I'm a recovering alcoholic. And they're fine with that. The first time that happened to me, I was about 3 weeks into the program. And I had to stop by down in Marietta to see a guy. And he's a talker. He's a very sociable guy. Likes to talk, likes to shoot the shit. You know, we were doing this, we're talking. I'm looking at my watch because I really don't want to miss my 6 o'clock meeting. He goes, "What's the matter? You got a beer somewhere waiting for you?" And I thought about it for a second and I said, "No, actually, I need to get to an AA meeting." And he said, "It works if you let it. I'll see you later." Everybody I've made my amends to has accepted my good faith efforts with goodwill. All the bad things that I thought were going to happen to me, talking to my boss, talking to my family, none of it happened. Everybody I have met so far has been uniformly pleased that I'm doing something to get myself out of the shit I was in and turn myself into the man I was supposed to have been all the time. My father died 5 years ago, soon after his 50th anniversary with my brother. And I was pleased that he had got to see the change in me, because I disappointed him so many times. And we threw him a 70th birthday party. And it was a great party. There was a lot of drinking there. And that was fun, because the other people that were there, they don't have a problem. I'm the one with the problem. As long as I don't drink, everybody will be happy. It's in everybody's best interest if I don't drink today. I keep reminding myself that. I joined my group conscience. I work on the board here at the Howe Place. I put my organizational skills to work, putting together the annual men's retreat. I do that instead of sponsoring because past experience has shown me I'm no good at it. I'm still a selfish prick inside. I have to keep reminding myself that. But I can recognize that behavior these days and try to ameliorate it. Try to not act that way. Try to do the right thing. My wife told me a few years ago that one of her friends, a good friend of ours, had thought for many years that I was the angriest person she had ever met. And I thought that was kind of surprising because I always thought I was kind of a happy-go-lucky guy. And, you know, as long as I have a couple of beers and everything's going my way and everybody's staying with my program, I was. But that's not the way life works. I'm an alcoholic and I want what I want when I want. Life doesn't work that way. Everybody doesn't want to do things the way I want them to do. Everybody doesn't want to act the way I want them to act. Everybody doesn't want to behave the way I want them to behave. I had a resentment against a guy with 20-something years of sobriety in this place because I never saw him pay for a cup of coffee. Am I the fucking coffee sheriff here? After about 3 years of driving myself crazy, I'd watch this guy walk by every day. He'd get himself a cup of coffee and he'd never pay for it. Son of a bitch. I don't have to be in control of everything. I still want what I want. But I understand that I get what I get. And I'm okay with that. My car's parked outside of the lot. The license plate on it says Serenity. I was real pleased I could get that. I was kind of surprised. Real pleased with it. And when I'm driving down the road, I hope whoever's behind me that really wants me to get the hell out of the way will get something out of it. Because that's what I've got today, most of the time. It's easy to have serenity when things are going your way. Things don't always go your way. I had to say the eulogy at my father's funeral, at my baby sister's funeral. I've been to a lot of funerals for people in this place that have died over the last 14 years since I've been here. And that sucks. I really hate going to funerals. But I do it because it's the right thing to do, whether I like it or not. And these days, I have that serenity. Because of the traditions and the principles, the steps, the community. I've said over and over that if you have a good, strong connection with your God, your family, and your community, you don't need to. I have that connection these days. And the only time the idea of drinking comes across my mind is generally when I'm standing in this room. So, serenity. That's my boast and my prayer for all of you. Thanks for letting me share.